everybody. So the topic of this panel is where do we go? We have James Fulford, John Derbyshire, and James Kirkpatrick today on to discuss where do we go from here. I believe Mr. Derbyshire has prepared a presentation for you. Oh, some of you in the back may have to stand up to see the video. Just make sure you are able to see it. We moved it up a little bit, but yeah, it will be on the screen. So adjust yourself and so you can see properly.
It will be higher next year. There's this plot module event at that time. So more books in need.
Thank you, Matt. I am John Derbyshire. And yes, I do have... That's very kind, thank you. And yes, I do have a brief presentation. I'm going to skip through it rather lightly. And it has a name. Yes, I've got to point where is it? Okay. And the name is Are We Doomed? Now, back in 2009, I published a book with the title We Are Doomed. So I actually wanted the title to be We Are Doomed, comma, Doomed. But the publisher said that was too negative. The subtitle was Reclaiming Conservative Pessimism. And I was just addressing it to American conservatives and pointing out that they weren't succeeding in anything because they had been too optimistic, and that the proper stance for a philosophical conservative is a careful pessimism. So now, 14 years on, just to set the tone for the panel discussion, which is the main point here, I want to discuss the question, what direction have we gone in the 14 years since I published that book? The national question, 14 years on, what is the national question? There it is. The national question is the title of Samuel Huntington's book, Who Are We? And there are people who will tell you we are a proposition nation. We believe certain things and that's what makes us a nation. And I say that's nonsense. You can be a yak herd up in the mountains of Tibet and believe all those things, but you're not an American. And contrary-wise, you can be an American and not believe some of those things, but you're still an American. So what is the national question? Who are we? And there's a quote from the book. To put it in the style of John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, which is a lovely book, but nobody reads it anymore. Right, fine book. The road of denial leads to the precipice of destruction. Didn't the great utopian experiments of the 20th century teach us that? Apparently not. Those are the chapter headings in my book, and the rest of my little presentation here, I'm just going to dance through a few of those headings. So I had a chapter on diversity, a chapter on politics, one on culture, one on sex, one on education, and so on. Here's a timeline for those 14 years, a sort of cultural-political timeline. From Obama becoming president at the beginning of 2009, through the Arizona law of 2010, which caused much controversy in immigration circles. That was the law that allowed Arizona state troopers to pull people over and ask them to prove that they weren't illegal immigrants. And then the DREAM Act failing in 2010. The Trayvon Martin shooting in 2012. DACA, 2012. The Boston Marathon bombing, 2013. The death of the Gang of Eight bill. The phrase comprehensive immigration reform mean anything? That's what went down when the Gang of Eight bill died. Michael Brown shot in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014. the Charleston church shooting, when several black congregation suffered several fatalities when a crazy white guy shot them up. And actually, that was what started the movement against any kind of display of the Confederate flag. And I know that because earlier in that month was my 70th birthday. And my wife and I did a tour of Civil War battlefields. That was my birthday present to myself. And Civil War battlefields, if you've ever done them, you know the big ones, they all have a sort of guest center where they have displays and little movies you can watch and things you can buy. And these guest centers, including ones run by the federal government, all sold Confederate battle flags when I did my Civil War battlefields tour. And I remember watching a crowd of young people, they looked like college students, coming out of one of those guest centers with a huge Confederate flag and waving it about and laughing and dancing around it. No more. And then Trump's presidency, his travel ban, the Remain in Mexico order, Title 42 enforced, George Floyd dying, and then Joe Biden becoming president. So that's a little cultural trip through those 14 years. Somewhere in there, you can't get much agreement on exactly where, is the Great Awakening. But you kind of get a clue that it was in the early 2010s, 2012, 2013. That's our best bet. This graph shows, excuse me, this red line is, I'm an old school teacher. Stop talking at the back there, please. This red line is the occurrence of phrases like racism, racist, xenophobia, white supremacy in academic papers, plotted from 1900 to 2020. And you see a sharp upturn around in the early 2010s there. And the same thing with sexism, sexist, misogyny, patriarchy, toxic masculinity. They take an upturn in the early 2010s. So that was the Great Awakening. I had a chapter on diversity, discussing all the different kinds of diversity. I'm a salt in the stew diversifile. I like a little diversity. I grew up in mid-20th century England when the guy who sold us ice cream was an Italian. And one of the girls in our class was Scottish, which we thought was very exotic. She was from Scotland, had a Scottish accent. So a little diversity. And then when I was in my teens, we got our first Chinese restaurant, and that was good too. But it was salt in the stew. You know, a little bit of salt spices up the stew. But you really don't want to dump a whole bag of salt into your stew, which is what we seem to want to do. Yes, okay. And I had a chapter on politics. Yes. The bottom part here, I'm borrowing from Peter. We have to recognize that we are in the early stages of a communist coup. It just crept up on us. That was Peter Bremelow talking at Amren in 2021. I had a chapter on culture with a little table that I'm still quite proud of, where I counted through the covers of Time magazine, the front cover of Time magazine, how many in each decade featured a novelist or a poet. In the 1920s, scaled because Time only started up midway through the 20s, but I've scaled them. scaled up. There were 16. In the 1930s, there were 13, and so on, down to the 2020s. I got to zero there, didn't I? When there was just one, and it was that strange young black woman who read the poem at Joe Biden's inauguration. Sex, yes. We have become much more feminized in these last 14 years, and it shows. There was a graph I saw, which I liked very much, but I couldn't find it when I came to make this presentation, of the sex of human resources managers plotted from back in the 50s when they started to be human resources managers in companies and other big organizations. And they were usually men back then. Now they're overwhelmingly women. I think it's 71% of HR managers are women. And same thing with colleges. I think our colleges overall are now about 60% female in the student body. And more women than men are getting bachelor's degrees. Oh, that's just a little piece I liked from the book. I'll just read it for you. Males are not biologically necessary. Plenty of species manage without them. One family of aquatic organisms, called the Bdelloid rotifers, seem not to have produced any males for about 30 million years, yet they are thriving. Whiptail lizards in the Arizona desert happily reproduce without sexual intercourse. The shuffling of genes that occurs in heterosexual pairing is useful to our somewhat more complicated species in keeping ahead of diseases and parasites, which base their attack strategies on the commonest genetic patterns of the previous generations. This shuffling can, however, be accomplished by fusing two eggs instead of a sperm and an egg. There are some small points to be cleared up. The placenta produced in egg-egg unions is unsatisfactory, but these problems can no doubt be mastered or mistressed. The trans revolution, we all know about that. I call it a willful defiance of reality. An astonishing business. And I had things to say about it in my podcast this week. Wouldn't catch up on that. Education, a vast sea of lies, waste, corruption, and crackpot theorizing. This is, again, me talking in my 2009 book. I had a chapter on human nature. I don't myself have anything to say about human nature, other than what I said in the book. But I'm friends with Nicholas Wade, who used to write science columns for the New York Times, and everybody was baffled to know why he got away with so much realism on topics like population genetics, writing for the New York Times. And I think it was Steve who suggested that perhaps the main editors of the Times didn't read their science section. Well, the last time I saw Nicholas, I asked him what he was doing. He said, "I'm writing a book." I said, "What are you writing a book about?" He said, "I'm writing a book about human nature." Okay. So let's see what comes out of that. Religion. You read mixed things about it. Is there an upswing in religious belief? I caught this in the New York Post, that young people are becoming a bit more religious. Generation Z, whatever that is, I can never keep those things straight. Generation Z shows a rising share of young adults having religious faith. But then, the churches are all in on the trans business, and you're having drag queen shows in between the sermon and the hymns. Oh dear. Oh, Methodists, Presbyterians. Presbyterians, I always thought Presbyterians were rather straight-laced, grim, Scottish types. But no, they're going queer with the rest of them. War. Yes, we all remember President Eisenhower's farewell address, telling us to guard against the military-industrial complex. Well, I suggest that what we have now is more of a bureaucratic judicial complex. We don't actually have that much of a military complex anymore. In Asia Times the other day, there was a report about that, and David Goldman commented that this is what happens when you can count the number of defense contractors on the fingers of one hand. We're not that military anymore. And of course, immigration. I've been having some exchanges with my podcast listeners and readers on something I said about this a couple of weeks ago. What's driving open borders policy? And the consensus is it's ideology. People pushing open borders have a fixed idea about ideology. They have a fixed ideological idea. Yes, it's kind of handy for the Democrats because they think they're going to get more voters, and they probably are. And yes, people want cheap labor and so on. But the most fundamental driver is ideology. So that's just a quick canter through the last 14 years of our Cultural Revolution. And perhaps while I was going through it, you got some ideas about what you'd like us to talk about and some questions you might like to ask. So I shall return to my seat and we'll commence the panel discussion.
Thank you. That was a great presentation.